produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Daily Audio Stash is where responsible marijuana smokers listen in on the latest news about cannabis, hear the voices of the marijuana law reform movement in special segments and interviews, and kick back with comedy and music no other podcast can offer. It's Normal's Daily Audio Stash. More information at normalaudiostash.com. First up today, it's news from Normal. Our news today. San Diego medical ID card challenge hampers patients' access in other parts of the state. Ventura County officials are holding back on issuing medical marijuana ID cards, saying that they will wait until the San Diego supervisor's legal challenge is resolved. Last week, the San Diego supervisors voted 4-1 to appeal a recent Superior Court ruling, rejecting their challenge to the ID card program instituted under California's SB 420. Ventura County had been working on its medical marijuana ID card program in July, but halted the effort as San Diego, Merced, and San Bernardino counties sued the state. 24 California counties have been following the state laws, issuing photo ID cards for qualified patients. Statewide, 7,830 cards have been issued so far. Cardholder information is entered into a statewide database so law enforcement can verify whether or not the card is legitimate. The cards allow qualified patients and caregivers to possess, grow, transport, and use medical marijuana. Last Thursday, San Luis Obispo County began issuing their ID cards. San Luis Obispo Community Health Services Manager Kathleen O'Neill said it took 6 months to implement the program and only about 15 minutes to issue the first ID card. O'Neill stated to the local press that county officials felt that implementing the program was a, quote, clear state mandate, close quote. While anyone in possession of marijuana can still be prosecuted under federal prohibition laws, the ID card program was intended to give law enforcement the tools to enforce state law by easily identifying medical marijuana users and not arresting them or confiscating their medication. Ventura County officials claim that they did not want to start up an ID card program only to have it shut down. However, in his ruling, Superior Court Judge William Nevitt stated that California's medical marijuana laws and ID card program is legal because it does not, quote, require, close quote, citizens to break federal law. San Diego's lawsuit has been the only challenge to any medical marijuana law in all of the 11 states that have such programs. Today on the Audio Stash, we're presenting our full interview with author Nell Bernstein about her book All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. We ran about 4 minutes of this interview last week on the Audio Stash and received a few dozen emails asking for more information. So we're going to run the complete 25-minute interview today. We also have links to the book at normalaudiostash.com. Today we'll speak with Nell Bernstein about her book All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. Nell is an award-winning journalist and former Soros Justice Media Fellow at the Open Society Institute. Her articles have appeared in The Washington Post, Mother Jones, Salon.com, Newsday, and many other publications. She also coordinates the San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents Partnership and is an associate editor with Pacific News Service. 1 in 10 American children has a parent who is under penal supervision, either incarcerated on probation or on parole. 1 in 33 American children overall and 1 in 8 African American children has a parent behind bars today. when half of all boys who have a parent in jail or prison will also wind up serving time. Here today, we'll talk about this epidemic of children in America whose parents are in prison with Nell Bernstein. She interviewed police officers, corrections officers, inmates, and the children themselves to bring us this book, All Alone in the World. Thanks for taking time to join us today, Nell.
Thanks for having me.
Now, first of all, how many American children are affected by this overall? I gave some of the statistics, but what's the big number out there?
Well, there's a couple big numbers. 2.4 million children have a parent who's currently incarcerated. And when you think about the fact that 1 in 10 have a parent who's under some form of penal supervision, that's just at any given moment. So the number of kids who've had this experience at some point in their lives or will have it is, you know, almost incomprehensible.
And this number has gone up significantly. It wasn't always like this in America. When did we start to see this uptick in children who have parents in prison, and what are the reasons for it?
Well, needless to say, the increase in children whose parents are incarcerated has exactly tracked increases in the prison population. And that is something that's happened over the past couple of decades. I think in the past 25 years or so, the prison population has increased something like fivefold, but the number of people behind bars for some sort of a drug crime has increased 12-fold. So that's really the policy change that's fueling this.
Now, children often get put into shelters out there in America, and those who don't have much experience with these social services may think that this is a good thing. But the kids themselves, what's their viewpoint of being put in these shelters?
Well, you know, let me say first that the kid who led me to write this book was a kid who was not even that fortunate. He was a boy I interviewed who told me that his mother had been arrested, and at 9 years old, he was literally left alone in the apartment with his baby brother. The baby was under a year, and those boys spent 2 weeks by themselves until somebody noticed and finally called Child Protective Services. Some kids are taken to a children's shelter when their parent is arrested, if the parent is, you know, by him or herself at the time of an arrest. And those kids over and over told me that if they were young, they thought they were being arrested themselves. They were transported in the back of a police car to a strange building they couldn't leave. If they were a little older, intellectually they understood they weren't being arrested, but they still felt as if they had done something wrong and were being punished.
Now, is there a common strategy across America for how police officers deal with children, you know, at the scene of an arrest?
No. After this kid, Ricky, told me that story of having been left alone, and after I heard similar stories from a number of kids, I started to look into it. And it turns out that researchers have looked at this and found that the great majority of police and sheriff's departments don't have any written policy or protocol about how to deal with children at the time of...
No protocol whatsoever.
That's right. So, you know, really what it comes down to is officer common sense, which is frequently exercised and sometimes not. And, you know, the situation where the police see the kid and leave him there, I did hear it more than once, but of course it's not the norm. But what happens all the time is that the kids are at school and the parents arrested, and nobody asks if there's kids, and those kids come home to an empty house. And lots of kids in that position have talked about spending weeks or in some case months alone.
So there's no requirement for these police to notify or even check up on kids or even ask the folks who they're arresting if they have kids at any given moment.
Well, you know, and I don't want to put it all on the police because it's not just them. There's no requirement that the police ask about kids when you're booked in jail. There's no requirement that anybody asks you if you have kids when you're brought before a judge. Not only is there no requirement that he ask you about or consider your kids under some of the mandatory sentencing laws that have been passed at the federal level, he's explicitly barred from taking your kids into account. Once you are sentenced and sent to state or federal prison, there's, with a few exceptions, nobody asks you if you have kids. And when you're released, your parole or probation officer doesn't have any responsibility for your family situation. Huh. So that's what was amazing to me, was that at every point on the criminal justice circuit, children, although they are profoundly affected and numerous, are invisible.
That's incredible. And now, not all police departments are doing this. You mentioned that there's, I see here, a child development community policing program in Connecticut. And how can police departments change the way they interact with children in these situations?
Well, you know, one thing I did in the book, in each chapter I look at a piece of the criminal justice process through children's eyes and through the eyes of a family or families. But I also, in each chapter, tried to go somewhere in the country where somebody was doing things better. And what I found was that there's not a single problem that I discovered, and I certainly came across a lot, that somebody somewhere hasn't solved. It's just always kind of the model program or the exception. And the one you're talking about is in New Haven, Connecticut. The police have a longstanding partnership with the Yale Child Study Center. Police there are routinely trained in child development. They have a 24-hour pager number they can call, and a therapist will come to the scene of a crime or an arrest and care for a child if that's needed. And they hold weekly case conferences at the Child Study Center to follow up on kids who have been affected by a parent's arrest or some other kind of trauma.
We're speaking with Nell Bernstein. Her book is All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. Now, women are one of the fastest growing segments of the prison population. Why are women being arrested more than they used to be?
Well, women are. The growth in the female prison population has been double that among men for several years running now. And that really is because they're increasingly affected by the drug laws. A couple of women I profile in the book, along with their children, were affected by conspiracy laws. And those in particular affect women. Basically, what it means is if you have a boyfriend or husband who's involved with drugs and you drop off a package or take a message, even if you don't know you're doing that, in other words, even if you don't realize that the message you're taking has to do with a drug deal, you can ultimately be held responsible for whatever quantity of drugs the entire network he's found to have been part of has sold. So that is definitely affecting women.
Now, also, low-level drug offenders are tending to get longer sentences these days, in some cases longer than a lot of the higher-ups in drug organizations out there. Is there something that, with drug policy especially, that is affecting the prison population? Is our drug policy just filling the prisons right now?
Yeah, I mean, you've said it. And when you go into a women's prison, it's the saddest place, and it is partly sad because everyone's talking about their kids. When I did a lot of the reporting inside the prisons several years ago, I was pregnant, and visibly so. And so the women immediately began talking to me about their children. But when you begin to try to find out what brought them there, if it wasn't a straightforward, you know, possession or possession with intent to sell, huge numbers of women there for writing bad checks, credit card fraud, welfare fraud, crimes that take place at the intersection often of, you know, drug addiction and survival.
And also just pure poverty. It seems in some ways that a lot of people are being persecuted for acts of trying to survive poverty here in America.
You know, and so that was the police chief in New Haven actually said that to me. He said, we can't arrest our way out of poverty, so we have to start here looking at the kids. And a lot of the frontline criminal justice people that I met got that because they're in it every day. I think that those who are a little more removed, and I hear this a lot when I, you know, talk about this with different audiences, assume that if somebody's in prison, and especially if they're doing a long term, there's a body on the ground somewhere. And just don't realize how very often that's not the case.
Now, drug policy isn't changing too much, but the alternatives to just prison are changing out there. What are some of the alternatives you've seen out there for drug sentences?
Well, one of the programs I looked at was a program called the Drug Treatment Alternatives to Prison Program. And I love this program. It's in Brooklyn, and it's run by the DA's office. That's what makes it so unusual. Basically, you know, they were trying to clean up Brooklyn and reduce the amount of drugs there, and they realized that sending these guys away for long sentences with no treatment, no rehabilitation, and nothing in the way of job prospects when they came home was not getting that job done. So the DA started this program where men and women who are facing long sentences under New York's Rockefeller laws, which are among the strictest mandatory sentencing laws in the nation, are instead sent to an intensive residential drug treatment program for as much as 14 months. So they're given drug treatment. The program I visited had all kinds of job skills classes going on all day long. And if they run or otherwise blow out of the program, they serve that long sentence that they originally would have faced. And if they don't, they go home to their families and they make their community safer instead of more dangerous. The problem, again, is that it's always the exception. You know, it's the model program with a couple years funding or happening in a couple of counties. And the thing that we pretty much empirically know doesn't work, which is trying to solve the problem of drug use through incarceration, is still the norm.
Now, how much do private prisons come into play? Here in New Mexico, most of our prisons are now privately run. Is the industry of prisons in America sort of hindering a lot of policy change out there, or maybe institutional change on the end of sentencing?
Well, you know, one thing I tried to do in the book is stay very grounded in the children's perspective. And we've talked about a lot of issues, and I have opinions on a lot of issues, but I really tried to look at each piece of the puzzle through kids' eyes. And when it comes to private prisons, the real issue is that once you're in the private prison system, you can be sent anywhere in the country if a cheaper bed opens up. You know, I don't know how many of the people in those New Mexico private prisons are from New Mexico, but a lot of times those prisons house people from other states. For example, Hawaii, where the cost of living is very high, sends a huge number of people to the mainland where they can get cheaper beds. But when you think about what that means for their kids, it's not just difficult. They're not going to get on an airplane and go see dad in Virginia or wherever he's been sent. And they're actually finding that the prisoners that they send to distant private prisons have a much higher recidivism rate than those who are kept close to their family.
We're with author Nell Bernstein discussing her book, All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. We have links to the book at normalaudiostash.com.
Now, how do kids interact with their parents? What's a visit to an incarcerated parent like in today's jails?
Well, you know, the first thing I would say is that unfortunately, most don't. 20 or 30 years ago, I think only about 8% of incarcerated women didn't get visits from their kids. Now the majority haven't received a single visit from their kids, and that's mainly because we've sited prisons way out in the middle of nowhere as we've kind of used them as a rural job development program. Those kids who do visit are going to face one of two scenarios. Right after mom is arrested, she's going to be taken to the county jail. And county jails almost universally have window visiting, which is what you'd recognize from television with the pane of glass and the phones. And that can quite literally drive small children crazy. They just don't understand it. A lot of reports of them banging on the glass, banging their heads on the glass. I heard about one toddler who became so hysterical when he couldn't get his mother out of the glass box that he wound up in the emergency room after the visit because he just could not stop crying. Once you are convicted and sentenced, you'll go to state or federal prison, and there the visiting is more likely to be a large open room, but there still is sort of a series of ritual humiliations that kids have to go through to get into that room.
When children need to see their parents in a facility, they have to pay all of the expense to see them there. There's no bus that comes out and picks them up.
I mean, occasionally there's a volunteer organization that will do that, but no. And it, you know, that expense often falls to grandma. And in California, where I live, for example, the great, great majority of our women prisoners, something over 7,000 of them, are housed in two facilities in a town called Chowchilla, which is basically, you know, if you took a pin and tried to put it in a map as far as possible from Los Angeles and the San Francisco Bay Area, where almost all the kids are, you'd pick Chowchilla. So, yeah, you pay the transportation, often a hotel. In California, they recently cut the number of visiting days so that people line up and sleep in their cars to make sure that they get in, because when you cut down the days, it gets more crowded and they cut it off at a certain point. Often wait in line for hours. It's a very taxing experience.
Yet in your book, there's one passage that talks about the grandparents making it almost a holiday, a special occasion, and making sure that they're showing the things that they're doing for their children, taking them out, taking them good places, cooking for them, and making sure that that they're out there. Children need to know. Here's an exact quote. Children need to know that they are wanted, that there is somebody called a father or a mother who thinks there's the bee's knees.
Yeah, that's from Liz Gaines, who runs a wonderful children's center at Sing Sing Prison in New York. She's also the mother of two children whose father has been incarcerated most of their lives. And she and her children have really shown me the degree to which, and this is practically a direct quote from Liz, a man can be a father from prison. Because a lot of people think that the conditions are so bad and that a prison is such a bad place that children shouldn't be brought there. And children and parents have told me over and over that, you know, even under the worst conditions, it's better to go, because when kids don't get to see their parent, they imagine it. And the dungeon of their imagination is almost always worse than the reality.
So this interaction is important no matter how it occurs. One would think the easiest interaction for prisoners to make with their children would be a simple phone call.
Yeah. But
that isn't so easy out there for prisoners as well. What makes that so tough?
Well, the only way that you can make a phone call from prison is to make a collect call. And those collect calls are made through individual private phone companies that basically bid for the contract with that particular system. And they are billed not at two or three times normal rates, but at between 4 and 20 times standard rates. And some of that money is profit for the phone company. A significant portion of it is kind of given back to the prison system or to the state general fund. So it essentially is an extra tax that not prisoners, but their families pay if they want to keep kids in contact with their parents. And as a result, it's pretty common for family members to have their phone cut off within a few months of an incarceration because they can't refuse the calls or they don't feel that they can, but they can't pay the bills either.
Now, you have a special relationship with the children of foster care. You interviewed 140 of them, 140 young people who had grown up in foster care, and you asked them their ideas for reforming the system. What did the kids who had been through it say should change?
Well, you know, that really was the other piece of what led me to this book. I sort of had and still have this idea that the only way to create better policy is to really talk to the people who are on the receiving end of that policy. So I set out to find out how kids who'd been in foster care thought foster care could be improved. And over, they let me know that I was asking the wrong question. They told me that they didn't want a better foster home. They wanted their homes. And they had such sort of clear, sensible ideas of what it would take or would have taken for them to be able to have their families. And the thing that came up over and over was drug treatment.
So drug treatment seemed to be one of the things. Drug treatment was the top thing on their list to see that their family and their parents could come around.
You know, and really what they wanted was resources for their families. You mentioned poverty, and the kids saw a clear link between poverty and the disintegration of their families. There's this term that researchers have started using, million-dollar blocks. A million-dollar block, and there are these blocks in most cities, is a block where that's what it costs each year to incarcerate people from that block. You know, and you talk to kids about what $1 million might do for their block, and they've got lots of ideas. You know, and that really, prison has gotten so common and so expensive that it, I think, really does play a part in draining the resources that families and communities need to stay together.
Now, we're approaching Christmas, and the holidays must be an especially hard time for families who have a family member who's in prison right now. I also noticed in your book that there was a telecommunications experiment going on where there were sort of virtual visits from the prison.
Right.
Do things like that help families get through the holidays a little bit more?
Well, you know, it's sort of two questions. The holidays are a time when kids who see their parents rarely often see them. One family that I looked at, the mother, Danielle Metz, is doing triple life plus 20 years in California, and she's from New Orleans. So that's where her kids were, one of them until recently. So this kid, Carl, would get out once a year to see her at Christmas, and he would talk about lining up to sit in the lap of the visiting room Santa and having Santa ask him, what do you want for Christmas? And sort of scoffing, thinking, I want my mother, what do you think? So there goes another authority figure. I did look at a televisiting program that a woman named Carol Fennelly runs in Washington, D.C. You mentioned private prisons, and D.C. a number of years ago closed its prison and shipped just about everyone out of state. So a lot of those men and some women are in private prisons, first in Ohio, then in Virginia. They've been kind of moved around. So that's a group of kids that has a particularly difficult time seeing their parents, and Carol has set up a uses teleconferencing software in the basement of a church in D.C. to have them visit their parents. You know, and it's a mixed thing. You know, when you watch a kid sort of groaning in frustration when the computer crashes, because I think that they had to use a regular phone line. There wasn't DSL in this neighborhood. When his dad says, give me a kiss, and he says, how can I do that? I mean, it's definitely better than nothing, but it also really lays bare how little these kids are able to grasp of their parents.
You talked about the million-dollar block earlier, and drug policy being one of the many problems filling the prisons here in America today. What are the civil consequences of criminal conviction? It goes much further than the arrest that day.
Yeah, one of the issues that I tried to look at, again, through kids' eyes was reentry. And I looked at the family of a woman named Dorothy Gaines, who is from Mobile, Alabama, so also in the path of the hurricane. And she is one of those women I was talking about earlier who was convicted to 19 years on just the vaguest of conspiracy charges. She had been dating a guy who was involved with a drug network. When she found out, she put him in rehab. When that didn't work, she left him. But she was sentenced to 19 years under federal law. Her conviction was so shaky that after 6 years, President Clinton gave her clemency, and she came home to her kids, who these kids had been standing on the corner literally with a sign with her photograph on it and a petition begging for her return. So you can imagine how thrilled they were to have their mother back. But when you get clemency, it's not a pardon. Your conviction still stands. And as a drug felon, she couldn't work in healthcare. She was a nurse technician by training and by experience, but that field was off limits to her. She wasn't able to find other employment because she had to check the box saying that she was a drug felon, wasn't able to live in public housing under federal law to receive welfare, food stamps, student aid. You know, the list went on. Every door was slammed in her face, as she put it. So these kids who had been dreaming of the day when their mom would come home and take care of them have now found themselves as young adults now having to take care of her. And that also is something that a lot of children face.
Now, if people are listening to us today and thinking, what can I do? What can I do to help children in my community in the case of their parents being arrested or imprisoned? What can people do out there? What's the best approach, and who should they talk to about the way their police department treats children?
Well, you know, it's a difficult question because there is sort of an increasing movement to help the children. President Bush is a big fan of mentoring and has put a lot of money into mentorship programs. A lot of the churches gather gifts for kids whose parents are incarcerated at Christmas time. And I guess, you know, what I would say is that reach out to the kids in your community, but respect their connection to their parents. If you're going to mentor a kid, make part of that mentorship driving him out to the prison to see his dad. Because that's really, the mentor's not going to be around in 2 or 3 years. And that dad is always going to be his dad, no matter how long his sentence is. So I think that's something people can do. I work with a group in San Francisco called the San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents Partnership, and we've developed something called a Bill of Rights for Children of Incarcerated Parents, which people can see if they like on our website, sfcipp.org, and we sort of have a list of action steps there that we're working in our community. We're meeting with the police this week, in fact, to work with them on a protocol. So I think that provides a decent skeleton for other communities that want to really take this on.
We've been speaking with author Nell Bernstein discussing her book, All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. We have links to the book at normalaudiostash.com. This has been Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Thanks to podshow.com for all the great pod-safe music. We feature the band Carne Cruda as our theme. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. Thanks to Red Aphid Interactive Media for the podcasting technology. We're back at 4:20 tomorrow. If you listen to the Audio Stash, cast your vote at Podcast Alley or other podcast directory services. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. The podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.